loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The CIA says that Russia interfered in the U.S. election in order to have Donald Trump become the next president. More than a month after his victory, why is the anti-Russia hysteria still being ramped up by the establishment and the Democratic Party, and now the Republican Party? And were these email hacks a malicious remote attack, or were they really leaks? When information is physically removed and released by an insider, we will explore that with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst. As Aleppo sits on the verge of being fully liberated by the Syrian army, Daesh launches an attack to retake the ancient city of Palmyra in Syria, sending thousands of reinforcements from Raqqa and from Iraq. Five-party coalition talks appear to have failed after Iceland's Pirate Party had been invited to form the country's next government. How does this party of activists and outsiders change Icelandic and European politics? And what comes next in the complicated process to form a government? But first, we turn to the anti-Russia hysteria and allegations of direct interference in the U.S. presidential election. We are joined in studio by Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst turned political activist and journalist. Ray is also a member of the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. Welcome back, Ray McGovern.
Thanks.
Ray, the New York Times ran an article on Sunday called "The CIA Judgment on Russia Built on a Swell of Evidence." But then the article actually says the CIA's conclusion does not appear to be the product of specific new intelligence obtained after the election, but rather based on circumstantial evidence. The VIPS, your organization, has issued a statement. How do you react to the Times story and, of course, the calls now both by Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and the House for an inquiry into the question of whether Russia directly interfered in the U.S. election to tilt or favor the election of Donald Trump?
Well, Brian, I think you misread swell of evidence. It's a swill, S-W-I-L-L of evidence, and it's incredibly suspect. What's really painful is the way the intelligence community has been out and out politicized. Now, take the CIA, for example, who's sitting on this swill of evidence. Well, today they did it again. They're talking about overwhelming circumstantial evidence. Now, we have overwhelming technical evidence. We have the former technical director of the National Security Agency who tells us that this is really just drivel. This is really just an operation to blacken the Russians and to blame the defeat of Hillary Clinton on the Russians. Why do we say that? Well, NSA has the capability and uses it all the time to find out who's sending what emails to whom. Can they do that in all cases? The answer is yes, they can. So everything is collected. It's like a dragnet. Everything on this planet is collected. And if it's not within this country, we have our allies, the Five Eyes, and seven or eight other cooperative intelligence services that pick up where we leave off. And so if there is evidence that the Democratic National Committee or Hillary Clinton's or any other emails has been hacked, NSA has that. Now, you don't have to rely on McGovern for that. Rely on the former technical director of the NSA. His name is Bill Binney. We don't play games. We're not anonymous sources. We put it right out there. We tell it like it is. And so this whole thing is artificially contrived for a whole set of reasons, you know, to explain why Hillary lost and to put a poison pill in Trump's attempts to create a more decent relationship with Russia. You know, peace, after all, is very, very bad for business. And And, you know, tension is pretty good for business, so is war. So these people stand to lose a lot. A lot of people are going to be canned in this city, and this is their last gasp to make their presence known, to try to excuse their behavior, and to pin all these kinds of things on the Russians. It was a leak. It was not a hack. Now, what's the difference? Well, we spell that out in this memo for people who, like me, are not really technically adept. A leak is when someone physically takes data out of an organization and gives it to some other person or organization, like Ed Snowden did, like Chelsea Manning did. It's really hard to detect because there's no electronic signature. Now, a hack, and this is where NSA can collect everything and knows everything about all these emails, that's when somebody in a remote location electronically penetrates systems, firewalls, cyber protection systems, and then extracts the data. Now, all the signs that we have, and these are technical experts with hundreds of years of experience, indicate that it was leaking, not hacking. If hacking were involved, NSA would know about it, and so they would also know the sender and the recipient. Now, there's no reason in God's world why they wouldn't reveal that if they had it, because this is rudimentary stuff. This is not highly sophisticated methodology. Indeed, you can buy it commercially. They're called trace routes. They trace the origin and the destination of everything on the internet.
So what your statement is saying, and what Bill Binney, William Binney, is saying, he works with you in the veterans group, the Veteran Intelligence Professionals Group, VIPS. And he's been on this show, Ray. Bill Binney has been on this show, and he has said, he's been maintaining for some time, that there's another Snowden or another leaker from within the NSA. What Bill Binney and what you are saying is that the CIA story is really based and would have to be based on intelligence that the CIA had gotten if there was hard intelligence from the NSA, but there is no hard evidence, and that the NSA is able to identify both the sender and the recipient when hacking is involved. And so it would be quite easy then for the NSA to trace where the hack came from and how it was delivered. And the fact that they're not doing it, the fact that they aren't doing it or can't do it, because certainly if they could, they would right now to make the case, that's further evidence, circumstantial evidence, but nonetheless perhaps compelling evidence that there is in fact a leaker releasing this data. Now, we know Russia has been, I would say, I don't know if afraid is the right word, but certainly concerned, alarmed perhaps, that the Hillary Clinton campaign, the Democratic national leadership orientation towards Russia has been highly confrontational, and that in the last few years, the policy of the Obama administration, especially in regards to Ukraine, but also in Syria and elsewhere, has been of a confrontational character with Russia. So it's obvious, one might think, why Russia would consider somebody like Trump, who say, let's have her press the reset button again, even though he didn't use that language. In other words, to have a normal relations with Russia rather than a confrontational relations. It might make sense that Russia would prefer Trump under these circumstances. But the point that you're making is that there's no evidence whatsoever that Russia actually did anything like directly interfering in U.S. elections, although the New York Times says this is really tit for tat because Putin knows that the United States, in fact, tried to interfere in electoral processes and other political processes in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Russia. Go ahead.
Well, you know, if I were Vladimir Putin and I was looking at the campaign that we just finished, the Germans have an expression. It was a choice between pest und cholera. Pest is plague. Cholera is cholera. I can't conceive of Vladimir Putin wishing to have a person with his finger on the nuclear button who makes a big braggadocio about being unpredictable, who reacts violently to any slight, real or perceived. That's the kind of person you want as your opposite number with his finger on the nuclear button? I don't think so. I don't think Putin had a really clear preference here. Of course, you know, Hillary Clinton did call him Hitler, which is about the worst thing you call anybody in in Russia, which people understand. So the whole thing is, well, let's go back to basics. When did this all come out? This all came out when Julian Assange released very, very prejudicial emails from the Democratic National Committee and from Hillary Clinton's server showing, now this is the important thing, showing that Hillary Clinton and the DNC stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders. It's clear as a bell. The problem is, Brian, nobody reads the content of those emails. It was a magnificent distraction when Hillary and her minions said, hey, let's blame this on the Russians. We'll say the Russians are hacking. They're trying to prevent the right person from winning here. And they succeeded in marshaling the entire resources of the what's called the mainstream media. And for a whole week, when the media should have been looking at the content of the emails, they distracted people into thinking, oh, it was the Russians, it was the Russians. So that's how it all started. There was never any convincing proof adduced. And when you talk about the CIA people talking, of course, you would never know their names and they never talk officially, but they talk a lot to the New York Times. CIA is not in this mix. The CIA is totally dependent on the National Security Agency, the NSA, for ground truth in any communications arena. So it's a mystery to me why my friends who, as I say, have decades of experience in this area, retired professionals, one of them, the technical director of NSA when he left a decade ago, why they would tell me that NSA would certainly have this if it was really hacking, and why the CIA spokesman, who depends on other NSA folks, would say, well, no, we just don't know. Or actually, they don't say anything. They let the CIA say things. So it's patently obvious that the CIA and others have this mission to accomplish, fully cooperated in by the mainstream media, to make it appear that the Russians not only are really bad people, not only have threatened us all over the world, but actually had a preference in our election and determined the outcome, namely Donald Trump. That is really pretty ridiculous.
Ray McGovern, when you think about it, there's only really one reason. Of course, that's never true. There's always more than one reason for everything. But the point that I'm making is that there's one real reason that Hillary Clinton is not going to be taking the oath of office on January 20th. And it doesn't have to do with Russia. It has to do with the fact that the U.S. uses the Electoral College as the system for selecting the president because she won the election. She's ahead by 2.5 million votes. It's been 150 years since there's been this kind of disparity between the popular vote and the Electoral College. She didn't win the votes in the right places. She lost by 10,000 in Wisconsin or 12,000 in Michigan, a little bit more in Pennsylvania. In other words, she lost in some battleground states, but the national polls predicted that she would win by around this margin, and she has, in fact, won by this margin. So why not? I mean, doesn't it just seem obvious to you that Hillary Clinton would be president except for the Electoral College? So, in fact, how did Russia actually change the outcome? Is the idea that Russia reached into battleground states, into Wisconsin, into Michigan, into Pennsylvania, into the industrial heartland, which have been cities that and communities that have been hollowed out, and that many of them voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, but this time voted for Trump because they bought his message that he would bring jobs, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's the real reason Hillary Clinton's not becoming president. But in fact, this gets lost in the anti-Russia hysteria right now.
Well, the statement issued by James Clapper, the National Intelligence Director, and by the head of Homeland Security indicated that it was, in their words, highly unlikely that any hacking, and especially Russian hacking, could affect the machines or the outcome in local or state elections. So you can rule that out. Even people who are now saying, well, you know, they may have hacked into other things, do not claim that where the shoe hits the ground that the Russians were able or even capable of doing that. So it's a charade here, and it's the last gasp by an establishment that what are we, we're a month after the election now, they still haven't been able to come to grips with the fact that a lot of them are going to lose their jobs, a lot of them are going to be canned, and some of them are fearful that Trump might hold them accountable, unlike Barack Obama, for some of the crimes they've committed. So this is their last gasp. They're trying to do Trump in, and the way they do that is say, whoa, he's going to play footsie with the Russians. Look, he says he likes Putin. It's really a canard, but that's all they have at this point.
Ray, what's happening now in the aftermath of the CIA report or the New York Times report about the CIA report is that Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky and the majority leader in the Republican Party, in Trump's party, said on Monday that he supported congressional investigations of a possible Russian cyber attacks to influence the American election. That, of course, sets up a potential conflict between McConnell and Trump. But he's also joined by Richard Burr, the senator from North Carolina, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Senator John McCain of Arizona. This is going to be a bipartisan effort now, at the same time that all of the media reports, not all the media reports, but primary media reports are demanding further investigations into Russia, like Russia is taking over the United States. I mean, it's really amazing. It seems to me, I mean, you have a lot of experience with the Cold War. We're hitting a stride here, which is almost unprecedented in terms of hostility and also something, a throwback to the House of Un-American Activities Committee. If you say anything, even like, let's be friends with Russia, that makes you a suspect. That makes you a possible Russian agent.
Well, that shows the depth to which the mainstream media has sunk. You mentioned some senators, but the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, from California, has said, I haven't seen anything yet. I haven't seen anything that's persuasive that the Russians hacked into anything. So we're selling a lot of airtime. We're selling a lot of advertisements. We're making it possible for a lot of people like McCain and Lindsey Graham and others to make big noise. But as I said before, this is their last gasp. When Trump comes in, and, you know, there are some people that are suggesting they're trying to prevent Trump from coming in. That's very serious. That's very, very serious. So what I would look to is, what are our armed forces doing? What are our organs of state security, as we used to call them in the Soviet Union, doing? In other words, is it at all possible that these pundits, these radio TV people, and these Congress people could actually think that they could mount some sort of a putsch or some sort of a coup to prevent Trump from taking office? You know, that's so beyond the pale for me that I don't even want to think about it, but some very serious people are thinking about it. And if that were their intention, this could be the prelude to that kind of action.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Ray McGovern. Ray is a frequent guest here at Loud and Clear, as well as many, many other media outlets. He's a journalist. You can read his writings at raymcgovern.com. He is also, in addition to being a former CIA analyst and a political activist and journalist, he is a member of the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, who have just issued their own statement, partly authored by NSA whistleblower and technical expert William Binney, who says, and they say, that this documentation, so-called, by the CIA, in fact, is not documentation at all. It is a canard. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Five-party coalition talks appear to have failed after Iceland's Pirate Party had been invited to form the country's next government. How does this party of activists and outsiders change Icelandic and European politics? And what comes next in the complicated process to form a government? We are joined from Iceland by Octavia Hrann. She is a member of the Pirate Party and a deputy MP. Welcome back, Octavia.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us what's taking place in Iceland at the moment. Reuters reported yesterday that the newspaper cited your leader as saying that the parties involved in the latest round of talks has not been able to agree on fisheries policies and on government spending, and she would hand back her mandate to the president later on Monday. In other words, giving up the effort to form a government led by your party. Talk about that.
So first of all, just a small correction. Birgitta Jonsdottir is not the leader of the Pirate Party. However, she is one of three members of the party that have received that can go and negotiate on behalf of the party. So indeed, they are right now with the president of Iceland returning that right to negotiate for a new coalition. Yesterday, it still looked as if we would have a small hope of joining this five-party coalition. Unfortunately, today, midday Icelandic time, that broke down. Yes, government, financial spending, and the fisheries were the two points that the five parties did not manage to reach around fully. Although I think our perception is that we were closer than a lot of other people think. It was very close, but unfortunately, we did not manage to find our way together, all five of us. There were three that publicly said that they were ready to form government and go into formal talks about forming that government. One was on the verge, and I think one which simply could not. So this is the second try. As you may know, the Left Greens did get a mandate as well and tried for a five-party coalition, and that didn't work. So indeed now, this is not that unusual for Iceland. There have been attempts of up to five attempts to form governments in the past. But we must admit, with the way that the election turned out, we are running out of options.
Okay, so help our audience. We have a U.S. audience and a global audience, but of course, for the U.S. audience, which does not have a parliamentary system, there's, I would say, a profound ignorance of how a parliamentary system actually works. So help us understand two things. One, who are the five parties? What are the dominant parties there among the five, or the lead parties? And then secondly, and after you discuss that, I want to come back and talk about what the fisheries policy and the government spending policies actually means in practical terms.
Well, so quite unusually, in our last elections here at the end of October, seven parties were elected into government. That's a bit unusual for Iceland. We haven't before had that many parties actually represented in parliament. Now, the largest party, the Independence Party, was given the first mandate to form government and did not manage to do so. And then one could say the pecking order then happens. The next largest, the third largest, the fourth largest, and so forth. So the Pirate Party was the third largest with 14.5% of votes. And we thus were given the mandate after the two largest parties did not manage to form a government to form one 10 days ago. Now, as you may know, it's been more than a month. We had elections October 29th. And so we do have up to 10 weeks before you could say that we really are in trouble and need to figure out perhaps alternative ways of forming government. But currently we're in the state where five parties, whereas the two biggest of this attempted five-party coalition are the Left Greens, who won, I believe, 15.7% of votes. The second largest, the Pirate Party, which were at 14.5%. The third largest was the Resurrection Party, which is a completely new party here in Iceland, and they gained seven mandates, I think about 11%. And then the two smaller ones, which were the Bright Future, they had four mandates, and and the Social Democrats, which came in with three. So these five parties have attempted now twice to form a coalition majority government. There's not really been a long tradition or history in Iceland for minority governments that your listeners may know from other Nordic countries such as Denmark. I believe it's only happened twice. So at this point, our president has asked for a majority government to be formed. And this, unfortunately, was what the Pirate Party, as the third party here now, attempted and did not manage to get through. The second part of your question is, I guess, well, just coming back to the majority government, we have 63 mandates in parliament, and thus to have a majority, you then need to have 32 or more mandates. And this five-party coalition would have had that if it would have gone into formal negotiations and ultimately would have formed government. Now, the two major things that I think are being set up as indeed the point that did divide the parties in the end, the fisheries industry is probably the main one. We have, where the pirates are in the middle, we do have a party, Resurrection Party, which is quite more to the right. And we do also have the Left Greens that are quite left. And so when it comes to the reforms that are needed in the fishery industry in Iceland with the current quota system, and hopefully with the new constitution being set in place in the next couple of years, there were ways in which we saw potential way to reach agreement. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. The major thing here, I think, for your listeners to understand is that as it is, the quota in Iceland are on very few hands. And at least four of the parties within this five-party coalition are really trying their best to reform it and put the fishing industry more on what you call an open and liberal market. And even though we did not manage to reach an agreement on that as such, I believe the Pirate Party had hopes that we would be able to bridge the gaps between some of the parties that were very far from each other that I mentioned.
And what's the Pirate Party's actual position then on the fisheries? What's your party's position?
Right. So we want the quota to be absolutely on a free market. So that's and also this is an important issue for us. We had five major themes that we went to elections on, and this is a huge part of that. We want to open up the market. We want to send all our fish on a free and open market, so everyone, in effect, can take place or can take part in the fishing industry and buy quota. Right now, that's not the case. As I said, it sits on very few hands, and so opening up for a more liberal market there, we think would be best for the nation as well as for the parties that companies that want to continue doing fishery in Iceland. It's very important for us that the nation and these companies understand that the natural resources of Iceland belong to the Icelandic people. They do not belong to companies.
So what we have in Iceland is a handful of perhaps monopolistic tendencies within the fishing industry. That's the problem that you're trying to address.
Absolutely. And one must also understand with a small nation like ours, monopolies do tend to happen quite easily. And so it is something that we struggle with in several industries. The way in which the quota system has worked since the 80s in Iceland, though, has indeed pushed under this monopolistic way of doing business. And we find that to be one of the major reforms that's needed.
And what about the issue of government spending? What's your position and how did it divide from the other parties, the other four parties that you were trying to form this government with?
I think that's a little bit of a more of a tricky matter. I don't think that my party sees that as the parties being that far from each other. I think it was a matter of understanding how our finances look now, that they weren't as good as perhaps perceived. And this is also something to do with the fact that there are many new members of parliament. There are many new members that are just joining. And so maybe understanding how much, in fact, we can and cannot do in this matter is quintessential. I believe there was a big bridging yesterday's meeting that furthered the understanding of where we could impose taxes, where we could take off taxes, etc. And so I think that was maybe some of the gap that really needed to be bridged was, are we willing to impose taxes for an undecided period of time on different things, including tourism and other things, to be able to bridge the gap that we have?
Where did you stand on that?
The taxation of tourism.
Yeah.
We do believe that we need to further tax tourism. We don't do that. There's a massive influx of tourists in Iceland, and we need to find a much more holistic and better way to address just regular things, as in the roads that need to be mended and just the pressure on our infrastructure. So we're quite open to inducing tourist taxes in various different ways. We weren't that fixated on one particular tax, let's say an arrival fee or a departure fee. We were ready to look at many different options.
Right. I hear you on the question of infrastructure. Here in the United States, the richest country in the world, one out of every nine bridges, according to all of the experts, is about to fall down.
Exactly.
But Octavia, the United States doesn't have best bridges, but we do have the best MX missiles. So that's small consolation for the people here.
Yeah, well, as you know, we don't have a military, so we can't boast of that. We do have, as you say, we also have trouble with bridges. We have one-way bridges in my constituency, actually more than 16 of them. And they do end in accidents and problems for our tourists and Icelanders alike every year. So we do need to improve our infrastructure.
Let's talk about the parties that have been historically dominant in Icelandic politics and why they have been unable to form a government. Your party previously ruled out forming a government with either the center-right Independence Party or a centrist Progressive Party. Then you have the decline in popularity of certain parties, such as the Social Democratic Alliance, that was once the largest party in parliament after the 2009 election. As you mentioned, they only garnered, I think, 5.7% of the vote in October. Can you talk about the sort of the constellation of political forces there?
Absolutely. I mean, for us, we don't want the Icelandic people to forget why we are voting in October. We never vote in October. The Panama leaks resulted in this. The corruption scandals resulted in this. So the Pirate Party are not able to form a government with the Independence Party nor the Progressive Party. And that we stand firm on. Now, for the Social Democrats, it really is a wave that you'll also see in the other Nordic countries and across Europe. It's been difficult for them here to kind of, I don't want to say reinvent themselves, but understand that after the crash, they took over a very difficult situation in a country. And since then, I think perhaps in popular opinion, they haven't really done their job, quote unquote. Let's say that in the government they formed after the crash, they finished perhaps 80% of their election promises. Unfortunately for them, the last 20% were the things that people really, really needed them to come through on, among them the Constitution. And I think the way that people are looking at them now is that they talk a talk, but they don't walk the walk. And so our voters punish that quite harshly.
The 2007-2008 financial crisis came from Wall Street. It came from the greed of Wall Street bankers. It came from their criminal activity. In the United States, 10 million people went into foreclosure to lose their homes. About 3 million actually did. Tens of millions of people had a decline in their living standards. Millions, maybe more than 20 million, lost their jobs. There was no accountability for those who committed these economic crimes. In fact, they were bailed out. For Iceland, it was particularly rough. I mean, Iceland had to declare bankruptcy. Help people remember, because even though it's recent history, for a lot of people, they might not remember what actually happened.
I think there's definitely a bubble here in Iceland that didn't really understand and never were affected. Truth be told, 8,000 families overnight, you know, became insolvent. And 8,000 families is a lot for a country of 330,000. We did have accountability. We did have a commission. We did jail the bankers. We did let the banks fail. But in a society this small in scale, there's also the need of continuance. And of course, many of the quote-unquote same banks did continue, but of course not in the same shape. They weren't bailed out. I think the consequences were quite harsh on us, particularly in the 4 or 5 years after. But with the boom in particular tourism and that industry becoming as large as it is, we haven't really had the long trail of aftermath that people thought we would. And you know, you can say what you like about former governments, but the fiscal responsibility of paying down debts has definitely been there throughout, whether that was a left or a right government. So I think in respect to that, we need to start making longer-term policies now. We need to not just be constantly reacting, whether that's to a financial crisis or to a massive boom in tourism. We need to set policies and plans for the next 10, 20, maybe even 30 years. And unfortunately, that's not the norm here in Iceland.
Octavia, we have 1 minute left. A real quick question. Why Pirate Party? Explain the name of your party, and what would be the main difference, say, between you and the left green party?
Well, why the Pirate Party? The Pirate Party is, of course, an international movement that started 10 years ago in Sweden. I think what attracted me personally, and I think what attracts most people to this movement, is that it believes in the freedom of the individual, the individual's pursuit of happiness, etc., which you obviously know in the United States as well, and the liberties that follow, the civil rights that follow that. But at the same time, also believe that government should be responsible, that we have ways in which that, when looked upon, could look quite more like a leftist party. I think the major difference between us and the left Greens is that we're not a left-wing party, first of all. We're a middle party. And second of all, I think we speak for the future. We want to update the policies and the laws of this country into the 21st century, not just when it comes to our privacy laws, but when it comes to fundamentally changing the system of governance here and opening up. Transparency is huge for us. And I think you'll find that the left Greens perhaps are a more traditional party and a left party. So those are probably the two major things I'd say. We're ready for change. And as you know, some of us are IT and, nerds even, and come from more of a systems thinking background. And we've been looking at the systems of governance and democracy for a very long time. And we do believe that it's time for a change, that more direct democracy practices are much needed in a world that no longer feels represented by the representative democracy.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Octavia Huron. She is a member of the Pirate Party in Iceland and the deputy MP there. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. On the brink of the war's biggest victory, is Syria's army immediately being thrown into another major battle? As Aleppo sits on the verge of being fully liberated by the Syrian army, Daesh launches an attack to retake the ancient city of Palmyra, sending thousands of reinforcements from Raqqa and from Iraq. We are joined from Damascus by Syrian journalist Ala Ibrahim. Welcome back, Ala.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining. We're talking to you from Damascus, Syria. Let's start with what's happening in the city, the historic ancient city of Palmyra. The Syrian army had recaptured the city from Daesh in March of this year, having lost it in May 2015. What is happening right now?
Well, in the time being, the Syrian army is pending of repeated ISIL attacks against T4 air base, which is the main air base of the desert of central Syria. As ISIL continues to wage a large-scale offensive on a front line that stretches for over 60 kilometers wide, ISIL is attacking several towns at the same time, Al-Qalatayn, Al-Bardi, all the way to Palmyra, including, as I said before, the strategic T4 air base. But according to my sources in the Syrian military, the army will be able to fend off ISIL attacks against this air base, and very soon a counteroffensive would start in the hope of regaining control of Palmyra.
Palmyra, is it mainly symbolic in terms of its strategic impact on the war, or is it, I mean, if ISIS were able to recapture Palmyra, of course it became famous in the West really because of the destruction of ISIS, by ISIS, of the ruins, etc. But if ISIS were able to capture and hold Palmyra even for a while, how important would that be either strategically or psychologically in the war right now?
First of all, from a military point of view, Palmyra does not have any ultra significance for the Syrian army and for the time being, because the army has lost control of big parts of eastern Syria. As a result, Palmyra is just another piece lost in a large sea of desert that separates or connects and Iraq. But the symbolic value of Palmyra, being the historical and cultural place it is, because of the fact that it has to do with preserving human heritage, and Palmyra is on UNESCO's World Heritage Sites list. This is why it is very important to maintain control over this city. And also, Palmyra has a symbolic value because it was the success story of the Russian-Syrian coalition against ISIL. It was the first major city where a joint military operation between the Russian Air Force and the Syrian Army managed to push ISIL out of the city and actually make substantial gains against the radical group, pushing it not only away from Palmyra, but pushing it 60 kilometers away from Palmyra. And this is why ISIL made a big deal of attacking the city, of having media coverage of its attack of the city. It immediately published videos and pictures, ensured everyone watching were following up, that it regained control of that important city for its symbolic and cultural value.
Right. If one looks at the map of Syria, you have Damascus in the southwest part of the country. To the north, but still in the west, is Aleppo, which was and has been Syria's largest city. Far to the east and to the north is Raqqa, but not all the way to the east, sort of still central east. And then Palmyra is sort of right in the middle between Damascus and Raqqa. So, and Raqqa, of course, is the capital of the so-called caliphate. Go ahead.
I was going to tell you that Palmyra is important in the Syrian army's military operation to break ISIL siege on the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is the eastern part of Syria's largest city, because Syria is divided usually into four parts. The eastern part, which is along the border with Iraq, the southern part, which is Damascus and the provinces around it. You have central part of Syria, which is from Hama. And you have the coastal part of Syria, which is the Fatah and Tartus. And then finally, you have the fifth part, which is the northern region, which is Aleppo and Idlib. And for the most important part of eastern Syria, or the biggest city, is Deir ez-Zor city. The city has a population of over 200,000 civilians. They are besieged by ISIL completely, along with a garrison of 10,000 Syrian soldiers. ISIL attacks the city on a daily basis. The Syrian army, when they took Palmyra, it was considered as a step towards breaking ISIL's siege on Deir ez-Zor. But we have to bear in mind that these are open desert areas. Maintaining control over such terrain is extremely difficult, because control is such an elusive term in deserts, because you don't have villages, you don't have cities to control, you don't even build. It's just open land where you cannot set up camps to defend these areas. So as a result, it was very difficult for the Syrian army to maintain control over the desert. The 60 kilometers of desert it managed to regain control of the north of Palmyra. And it was very difficult for the army to maintain control over the oil and natural gas fields of the north and east of Palmyra. And as a result, even for ISIL, it will be difficult to maintain control of ISIL. It will be capable of doing if the Syrian army attacks. It can use booby trap cars, explosive devices, car bombs, suicide attackers, to make the operation costly for the Syrian army. But it will not be able to maintain control over desert areas for a long period of time, which is the same case for any military powers trying to maintain control over the desert.
Talk about Palmyra's historical significance in Syria. It is an UNESCO site. Just for our audience, which is mainly in the United States, but also a global audience, for Syrians, for you, what's the significance of Palmyra historically and culturally?
Palmyra was an oasis kingdom at the time of the Roman era, and at the time of the Roman Empire, Palmyra tried to seek independence and create a state of its own, managed to control large areas of land around it, and it became an influential regional power back then. And then the Roman Empire wanted to subject Palmyra into its rule. And after fierce fighting, Palmyra was ruled by a queen, her name was Zenobia. And after, as I said before, fierce fighting and endless battles, the Roman Emperor managed to capture Zenobia as his captive, and later on as his slave. She was brought into Rome in shackles, and signaling the end of that rogue or mutant little state, which is Palmyra. But since then, it has a very unique place in the heritage and in the minds and in the culture of Syrians as a tribute for seeking independence and fighting against the odds, fighting against the very difficult odds. Understand the comparison between the power of Palmyra back then and the power of the Roman Empire. It would be like comparing the powers of the United States of America, the powers, for example, of Kuwait in Gulf, which is a very small and insignificant state in terms of the military abilities the state has. But despite this, Palmyra tried to seek independence, and it it achieved some of that independence for quite some time.
The Guardian newspaper in the UK, they write that they're quoting this Syria's director of antiquities, and of course, the ruins, the artifacts, the archaeological sort of gold mine that Palmyra is, and which was so severely attacked by Daesh when they controlled the city before. The director of antiquities said, "The catastrophe has happened. I am in absolute shock. I am losing hope. It looks like we have lost the city." I mean, that's understandable from his point of view because he's trying to guard these historical treasures. But psychologically, does it also indicate to you that while Aleppo may be being liberated, that the problem of Daesh or the strength of Daesh is such that there's going to be no easy or even soon or possible remedy to the conflict in Syria?
Well, I'll tell you something. The issue of ISIL is a very complicated issue, and despite the fact that the loss of Palmyra to ISIL is a loss to all humanity, it's not just a civilian loss. It's not just the loss of the Syrian government or the Russian allies of the Syrian government. It is the loss of humanity because it's a part of the heritage owned by all human beings and not just Syrians and not just people from the Middle East. But the conflict against ISIL is a long one, and it won't end anytime soon. You have to bear in mind the politics involved in this conflict will even prolong it for a longer period of time. We know that the U.S.-led coalition has been operating in Iraq for years now against ISIL, and it's for many Syrians they find it very weird how ISIL fighters managed to travel for hundreds of kilometers in open deserts without being detected by U.S. satellites and U.S. drones always flying over Syria and over Iraq, and how ISIL managed to move hundreds of fighters from Iraq into Syria. The point I'm trying to make here is, because of the politics, I don't think there is a consensus on defeating ISIL, despite what everyone says. Everyone says we want to combat terrorism, everyone says we want to defeat ISIL, but I think the politics here play a major role, and defeating ISIL is not a priority, at least for certain parts in the conflict. I've heard many analysis that the United States could be happy now in a way that ISIL gained control of Palmyra, because this means that the Syrian army would divert its attention from Aleppo, hence going down what could be the major victory of this war for the Syrian government and the Syrian army and their allies. But again, these are just analysis without any backing or official statement. What I can tell you for a fact, from my coverage of the Battle of Palmyra in May 2016 when the army lost it, in March 2016 when the army regained control of it, and in November this year, just a few days ago, I went to Palmyra to cover Syrian army preparations because they knew ISIL was moving fighters in that direction. I can tell you for a fact that without proper support from superpowers, without technology, without satellite information, without high-tech drones, without new weapons, it will be very difficult for the Syrian army to defeat ISIL in open deserts, such as the areas in Palmyra. It will be very difficult for the Syrian army to break the siege in their reserve, which is the largest besieged site in Syria, besieged by ISIL for over 2 years now. And it will be very difficult, actually, to even regain control of the first proclaimed capital of ISIL, Aleppo.
We're talking with Ala Ibrahim. He's in Damascus. He's a Syrian journalist. So about the victory of Daesh, to take Palmyra, the city they had originally taken and then lost to the Syrian army. And you were in Palmyra recently. In other words, you were just there. You were there days ago or a week ago or something.
Yes, to be particular, on the 17th of November.
Right. Let me ask you, you're suggesting by your analysis that the victory or near total victory of the Syrian Arab Army in Aleppo has been considered by Washington to be a setback, even though the purported role of the United States in Syria is to defeat ISIS and other terrorist forces. And I think you're also suggesting that perhaps the United States was both sympathetic and perhaps facilitative of the ISIS taking Palmyra in order to stop the momentum of the Syrian Arab Army. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, what I'm suggesting and what I'm saying very clearly is that the United States of America, the U.S. coalition, with all its members, Arab members and European members and the United States have turned a blind eye to the active movement of ISIL through the desert connecting Iraq and Syria. They have turned a blind eye to ISIL moving oil from Syria into Turkey and selling its oil in Turkey. It has turned a blind eye to the fact that ISIL would have never flourished without the continuous support of the government of the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, which is a member of NATO. And I'm saying very clearly that ISIL is completely dependent on the help of regional powers in the Middle East, regional powers that have for long been considered allies of the United States, like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And I'm also saying very clearly that, yes, the United States have turned a blind eye to the advancing units of ISIL towards Palmyra. It's simply they don't think this is their battle, and if the Syrian army and ISIL fight each other, and one would lose, and they wouldn't mind it because they think of both of them as villains and should be defeated. And I also think that the United States of America would be, at least the current administration of the United States of America, would feel very strongly against the recent gains made by the Syrian army in Aleppo. Let's bear in mind that some of the rebel factions inside Aleppo are factions that have received support and aid from the United States for years on end since the beginning of the conflict in 2011. And it would be a setback for the U.S. policy in the Middle East for these factions to be defeated in the way they are being defeated in Aleppo right now.
Allah, we have only about 1 minute left. I want to ask you this, and I want to thank you for your last answer, but I want to ask you this. Yes, the United States has turned a blind eye. The United States allies like Turkey, the eastern flank of NATO, a U.S.-led military alliance, have been indispensable for the growth, the support for ISIS in many ways, as have other regional powers like Saudi Arabia. Does ISIS have any base of popular support among the Syrian population, or are they simply an extension of foreign powers?
That's a very difficult question. To answer your question, I'll ask you another question. What do any human being want? What any human being wants, from my experience in the Syrian continent, they want stability, and stability is essential to any human being, and that stability would include elements of safety, elements of some kind of financial stability, some kind of political stability. And in comparison between, for example, ISIL and other rebel factions, I've heard many feedback and many viewpoints inside ISIL-controlled areas of Syria that they prefer ISIL to other rebel factions because they share similar ideologies of ISIL's stricter, yet it's clearer and it has clear laws and has sustainable structures and steady laws, and you can deal with them. It's very difficult. They're backward. They're criminals. They would behead people. They would flog people. But at the same time, they have clear laws. Unlike other rebel factions, where the situation would be more messy, more chaotic. So, as a result, I heard many viewpoints from people living under ISIL that they prefer ISIL in other rebel factions.
Well, that's all the time we have. We've been speaking to Allah Ibrahim from Damascus. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.